This is Germ Warfare, the battle of ideas.
Well, I'm just an ordinary Dutch kid, actually. And an adult, but I grew up just in the province outside Amsterdam. And when I came out of the army, when I was 17, I went into the army. I was a bit of a rascal and stealing cars and this and that. And I went into a jail when I was, I don't know, just 18, 19, maybe, just when I came out of the army. And then, the dog is here. Come on, go away. And I'm a bit distracted. And then my brother-in-law, he owned a few coffee shops here in the Red Light District. And I came there to sell, actually, a Timberland shoes. I nicked a bunch of shoes from a Timberland shop. And I didn't know where to go with the big sizes, a 40, 44, 45. And then my sister said, well, listen, Alfred, he wears always Timberland. And he's got, like, I don't know, size 45 and a half or something. So I went with big shoes to my brother-in-law and sold him the shoes. And then he asked me what I was doing besides nicking stuff out of shops. I said, well, not much. He said, why don't you come and work here as a doorman? So that's the way it all started. That was in 1985, something like that, 1986. So I became a doorman in a coffee shop here, right in the middle of the Red Light District. And soon after, I started to sell from the menu, you know, the hash and the grass and, from a plastic flap thing, you know. And within a couple of years, I took basically over the show there. You know, my brother-in-law promoted me first to provide all the shops of hash and grass. And soon after, I was responsible for the whole department. And, I have to kick the dog out maybe because he's making noises in the background. But that's, basically, also, okay. Sorry, mate. You have to cut this out most likely. I'm sorry. Hey, I after like 7, 8, 9 years, I stepped out of the shop. My brother-in-law sold them. He got involved in a shooting, and he had problems with the Hells Angels, you know, because they wanted to have protection money. And paying that wasn't in particular in my brother-in-law's dictionary. So, that's a bit the story, Jeremy. Well, you want to know
so,
more?
I mean, all of this is in your book, Fast Women, Slow Horses, which of course is a... that's a phrase it's a term that people know. But I mean, in the context of your book, what does it mean?
Well, I did make a shitload of money, and I spent it basically, and that's what the fast woman slow horses means. That's I heard it from a mate, or I have to say I didn't know that one, because I published a book already with a publisher in London. A hybrid contract. Actually, I wrote two books, and with both I had a contract. But I can advise everybody, forget these publishers in London. They're all rip-offs there, all of them. They take your money, and that's basically what they do. You know, they abuse starting authors, and they ask them to pay money for proofread and this and that, and they're all bullshitters. Anyway, so... one of them actually went bankrupt. It's called LR Price, Olympia. There's like a few of them. Austin McCauley, Eurobooks. Forget about these. They're only taking your money, nothing more than that. So anyway, I put it together in basically two books, Fast Women, Slow Horses. And a mate of mine said that he mentioned that phrase, and I liked it. So
Your story is why I invited you on, because it's such a fascinating journey. And of course, as you said earlier, it's in your book, but it starts off with you had a you grew up in a middle class upbringing, but you didn't have a very good relationship, a very good family setup. If that's correct, you had issues with your father,
father was an alcoholic. My mom, she was bipolar, although there was not really a diagnosis like that, but most likely she suffered from bipolar. And I think also that's, you know, in hindsight, I think a lot of people, because I got addicted, you know, like I was when I was in my 30s, and I went through all these, you know, AA, NA, SLAA, and what I see with many people who have addiction problems, that they, you know, the upbringing, you know, loveless, no love, no attention, and that's something you really see with a lot of people, you know.
And your mother stole, is that right?
Yeah, she was a kleptomaniac. Yeah, she loved it. I don't know, she was addicted to it, I think. And she always brought loads of clothes and stuff. And even when she got arrested a few times by the police, and then my sisters got placed another family, and they pulled the whole family apart, you know. We were with five of us. My oldest brother went to a boarding school, and I was actually the only one left with my mom at the end. And
And then in your teens, you started skipping school and you started stealing things also.
Yeah. It started off. I raised myself basically. My mom, she didn't have any control. Nothing, you know, and I don't think she had ever the ambition to win control back. And she was mostly locked up in a room, and I came home whatever I liked, and Tito with an askris, you know, for leaving. She didn't care. She didn't care, you know. No.
And then you ended up in the Air Force guarding nuclear weapons.
Yes, in Vurden, at 12 group guided weapons. Well, you got drafted in them days. Eh? You had to go to the army. And I even signed up to go, you know, earlier. I was only 4 months 17 when I went into the army. I remember, because you got your first payment cash, and it went on age. And there were like 300 young guys, and I was all the way at the end. I was the youngest from all of them. It was a couple of hundred guilders. I remember that very well. Yeah.
Take me through the next phase, because that's where the whole drug thing started.
Well, I didn't like the army. So normally you had to stay in, I think, 16 or 18 months. But I left after maybe 10. I went to the border area, just over the border, Germany. And I stayed there for a while, went back to my mom because I didn't have money anymore. And the roof went off. We had fights, and the police had to come a few times. So a social worker put me on top of the list for a social house. And I had some mates in. We stole cars, we broke into shops, and although it was just making extra earnings, or because I always had a job, actually. And from one came the other. I don't know. I ended up in jail at the end, because I got caught here in Amsterdam, because at night we drove with a stolen car full of loot from a lingerie shop. And we put it on a drink somewhere here in the red light district also. And suddenly the whole bar was full of police. And, got arrested, ended up in jail in Leeuwarden in the north of Holland for a few months. And when I came back, the police was on top of me. And I come into that story with the Timberland shop. It was around the corner. There was a new Timberland shop. And I broke open the back door, took a whole bunch of Timberlands, and sold them like I just said, you know, and I had a few full big sizes left. Sold them to my brother-in-law here, who I met, a Jewish dude from Brooklyn. Oh, now he starts with another one. Sorry, mate. I need to take these things away because he makes noise. So, yeah. Where were we? Shop, Amsterdam. So I came and worked as a doorman. And for my brother-in-law, he offered me a job. And well, soon I rolled into the hash and grass business. And from, yeah. And soon I climbed up again, you know. I did that for like 10 years. And in them years, in the 80s and the 90s, yeah, you could make a lot of money here in Amsterdam. I mean, my goodness gracious. Everybody who was in that business around that time knows that. I mean, the money was almost literally hanging on a tree.
And then you went international.
Yeah, I, of course, met a whole bunch of people. This, you know, you have to see it like this. Amsterdam was like a big hub for especially hash and grass in the whole world, actually, especially Europe. I mean, all Europeans bought their hash and grass here in Amsterdam or in Holland. And they came from all corners. I even had people from Japan, Australia, United States, Canada, you know, who bought hash here in Amsterdam. You know, they sent it with the mail or whatever, how they took it. But I mean, I sold to all kinds of nationalities, most of them, of course, Europe, Irish, German, Swiss, Italians, Scandinavians. And yeah, so you come from, you, of course, you expand your circle and you meet other people, people who import and all kinds of stuff. And with them, we started stories like from Morocco to Ireland. And like I said, it was a hub. So there were people coming from Ireland, for example, and they just bought a couple of hundred kilos. So we set up a line to Ireland or England. I mean, yeah, that was what I did. And there was a lot of money in it. I also, for a while, bought all the hash and grass that was of inferior quality. And I put it in repress and made it a new product again, you know? And, well, Jeremy, mate, I mean, I don't know what I did with the money, but the money was crazy. I mean, there were weeks. And then I was a kid of like in my late 20s, 30 years old. I made like 100,000 a week sometimes. And that's not
Yo, that's good money. I'm in the wrong business.
It was mental. Well, it's not like that anymore, Jeremy. That whole story is over. This is not a hub. There's still coffee shops here. It's actually loaded here behind here, the Haarlemstraat. There's many of them here, but Holland is not the hub anymore. That's all.
You use the term luxury junkie. What is that?
Well, I never was a dude. I give you an example. Recently, a mate of mine who I know for 30 years, and he read the book also, and he said, "Fucking hell, I never knew actually it was that bad with you." Because I wasn't on it every day. I wasn't like the typical junkie sitting in a doorstep or something. I was just a guy, you know. Once in a while, I just, they call it in the AA, they call it a bender, you know, or there's a few names for it. I can't remember now, but that was I did it every couple of weeks. I went just totally out of my skull. With prostitutes, red light. I stayed away for sometimes 2 days, and I spent fortunes. There's here an Overtone, for example, a club. I'm mentioning that one also in the book. It's called the Golden Key. Well, they normally close at 4, but they stayed open especially for me till 4 the next day. I mean, and then you're talking about money. Then you're spending €15,000-20,000 I was spending on a night sometimes.
What sort of drugs were you involved with?
Yeah. Mostly cocaine. That gives that cocaine and sex, but it's with a lot of drugs, because when I'm at NA, of course, I talk with all kinds of people. Some people have the same with methamphetamine, you know. I remember a dude saying, you know, when he was sharing, he said, there is no sex like sex on methamphetamine. All sex afterwards is just boring, you know.
Part of your drug trafficking in your book was between Morocco and Antwerp of about 14 tons or something.
14,770 kilos, yeah.
That's not small.
It's also... No. I describe exactly how we did it, and from the beginning, you know, it was here in a very notorious bar here in the west side of Amsterdam, which is now a bagel cafe.
How did you do it?
And then I met
In a nutshell,
the mate, I saw my mate there, who I knew he was an expert in building in stuff, in drugs, you know, hash, in cars and buses and drugs. And he was looking for a truck driver, somebody with a truck license who wanted to make some money. And well, I said, listen, mate, I've got it. I said, well, I've got 5 tons of hash laying in Rotterdam. It was Zwijndrecht. And I want somebody to bring it to Belgium. And I give it 10 a kilo. I think, oh, that's 50K. For an afternoon drive. So I said, well, mate, I'll do it. No props. And, well, all went fine. We did it. And then I came into another story with him. We spoke to the guy, an Algerian guy, I think, in Brussels. He was the dude who reigns everything. And he said, listen, I want to have a big load from Morocco. Can you all organize it? Can you set up a company, you know, and then we'll send some stuff there, a few dry ones, and then we'll fill it up. So we did. So the whole bloody story took almost a year. And I was actually the only one at the end. I described it also, who literally bloody escaped, because my mate didn't believe. You know, we had a company in Mechelen, and it was I'm thinking in three languages, industrial area. And at the day, the trucks would arrive with two containers. Both of them had 7 tons, more or less, building in a double thing, you know, from the container. And he says, listen, I'll wait. We studied the map. I'll wait on this road, because they have to come from the port of Antwerp. They could come on this road or this road. They said, okay, I'm going to stand there and see what happens if they're getting followed. And I wait at the overpass. Okay, so I wait there. I see the trucks coming. Exactly, I remember 1 o'clock they had to arrive. Normally, they always were hours too late, but they were spot on 1 o'clock. I see the two trucks driving over the overpass. I think, wow, banga. And right after, I see three, like, limousine cars, like a big BMW, Mercedes, Volvo, with a whole bunch of antennas on the roof, with all, like, these marine kind of fucking guys in it, you know, driving. So I knew it was wrong. So I sent my mate a message. I said, listen, throw the towel in the ring. It's off. It's gone. He couldn't believe me. He said, I didn't see anything. Well, listen, mate, believe me, forget about it. And we had the director, you know, a dude. He was waiting to sign for the containers. And we drove past by, you know. I said, just don't stop. Don't look. I had the map in my hand, and we looked, and we didn't see anything. We saw our director standing in the doorway. He was mopping the floor or whatever, the brooming. And he couldn't believe it. He said, mate, there's nothing going on here. I said, listen, you know what we do? We go back to Antwerp, which was like 60, 70 kilometers from there. We go to there was a cinema complex there. Can't remember the name now. And there was a Burger King, and you could see the whole parking lot there. I said, you know, we send the director a message that he comes back there and we can exactly see what goes on. So we went there, sent him a message, come to the Burger King. And from there, you need to take the train back to Holland. While we were sitting there, 3-4 o'clock in the afternoon, there was not a soul there, a massive parking lot in front. And then we saw him coming from the highway. We had a beautiful view there. And we were the only ones in the Burger King, you know? And he came with his rental van with all kinds of very obvious van he was driving. And then we saw one after the other car behind him. He got followed, not by one car, like 7 or 8 police cars were behind him. So, we were sitting there. I mean, he was a sitting fucking duck. They were all stopping there. He stepped out, the director, and he out of our view. And all these cars were parked there, like 7 cars. All of them had 1 or 2 guys in them. And they were all police cars, all police. And, well, I knew the way a little bit. So I said to my mate, listen, I'm fucking out of here. I don't know you. I'll see you back in Holland. This is wrong. I said, I just walked into the parking downstairs. And he went out along the main staircase. The director comes. He starts, "Hey, Rudy, hey, mate." Bang, 6 years. 6 years he went to the jail.
And the director, because of that.
I think, only because of that, yeah, of course, they could put the whole story together, you know. I don't know exactly.
Do you think that was on purpose? Was it betrayal?
No. It got tipped off by some from Morocco. So that's a long story, Jeremy, but. There were a few participators in this story who invested in it. And there was a quarrel between a few Moroccans, and one Moroccan kicked out the other. And this person sent a few times to the Belgium authorities, you know, information about this particular. He knew, of course, the ins and outs. They knew that it was in Gibbs, you know, the stuff, that it was hidden in there. So the police knew more or less there was a few containers coming from Morocco. And they knew more or less the date. And we had the customs paid off in Antwerp. But because there was, of course, a team of the police, yeah, it doesn't really matter then, you know. I didn't go to jail. My mate, he fled the scene. And he went with a false passport to South America. That's where he lives now, by the way. He lives in Colombia.
Colombia.
And he lives in Colombia, Medellin already. Already years. He's married to a Colombian lady. We're still good friends. But of course, they searched for him. There was a search warrant for him. And I think years later, he traveled with a false passport between, was it Argentina and Colombia or something? And he got caught and they sent him back to Belgium. And he had to do his time. But it's all a long, long time ago. We're talking about, I think this story happened in April 2004.
Yes. So the two guys that went to jail, was it Lang and Ferry?
Lange and the director, what was his name? He's dead now. Horrible man also.
But there were two of them.
Don't matter. Ferry is his name, Ferry. Yeah, Ferry.
And they each got 6 years.
Yeah, and also two Moroccans, because after that, of course, they started to dig in the police. They did a few months of investigation, and they came to the guy who bought the diapers, because we send the diapers to Morocco, you know, as a load, and it came back with gypsum, you know? So that's the way we send the containers up and down between Belgium and Morocco.
But in your book, you speak about... You speak about spending thousands of days in various prisons around the world. Is that true?
Yeah, I did. Not for this story, but I've been in Belgium for laundering money. That was in 93, I think. I got caught with a few big bags of pounds sterling. That was a massive amount of money. It was 600,000 pounds. Well, at the end, when the police counted it, it was 530. So I don't know. They must have had long fucking fingers. The police there, because there was 68,000 pounds missing, which they used against me because I said, well, we counted the pounds. You said to us it was 600,000 pounds, but it's only 534 or something. It was. I said, listen, a few notes could be missing, you know? You know, these machines, maybe there's a few fake notes in there. Then they right away put it in the paperwork. Suspect admits counting the money lazily, which more even, you know, that it's probably money, criminal money or something, you know? But then they stole 70,000 pounds. That was quite obvious. And anyway, I've been in jail for that, yeah. Yeah, yeah. That was a shitload of money. That was in Gilders. That was in Gilders, almost 2 million Gilders they took away from me. And they confiscated money in Luxembourg I had on an account because my mate was still driving around already a couple of months with a slip of the bank in his car who got, you know. And also I paid bail, 1 million Belgian franc, which is 50, well, a shitload of money. And I got convicted, but I never went back anymore. So I stayed away from Belgium for 10 years.
Which other countries?
Well, and which other countries? I've been in Spain in jail for grass. That was in 2015. And not so long ago, I did a bit of time in the UK. That was unbelievable story. I don't even want to talk about it. It's not in my book either.
Okay, well, then I won't ask. But how did you end up in South Africa?
I met a few Irish kids. David Babyface. Lindsay was his name, yeah. And, I met him here in Amsterdam via an old mate of mine. And he said, listen, could you arrange, because we've got a door in Port Arlington in Ireland, and we could have a door there, pay door, so could you mean anything? And he knew I was married, my mate, that I flew up and down to South Africa once in a while. So I said, well, let me take a look. And I contacted, I think, via a dude, the Hells Angels, actually. And then I ended up, they said, we've got some contacts there. Who can fill it in? Five tons of grass we need to have. So then I traveled to South Africa, met a few Hells Angels there and people who were connected. Paul was his name, I remember. Big, big, fat dude. And, then the whole adventure started, let's put it like that, you know? And at the end, I think it took also like 10 months. And what a story, that whole South Africa. It got nicked, or we lost it in Port Arlington. Apparently, the door wasn't as good as what the Irish said. And this guy, actually, later on, because I lost contact with him once, he lived in Amsterdam, just outside Amsterdam, in a little house next to the A2. I lost contact with him. And then I heard he totally disappeared. Nobody heard anything from him and his mate anymore. And I looked years later. I put in David, Babyface, Lindsay, and I found out they never found him back. He got murdered, and his body probably dumped in the Irish Sea, chopped in pieces or whatever. You know the guy.
Gee.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. These things happen. Yeah, yeah. So there's quite. I think. Yeah, in these years, I mean, I know dozens of people who got killed, disappeared, chopped up or whatever, you know. I don't know. I think I come from 2000, I think 25 people or something. It was an average every year that somebody got murdered, you know, in my circle.
How did you avoid all of that?
You only get murdered once, mate.
I mean, were you Were you very alert?
Well, listen, when you look, yeah, but listen, when you look at all these people, like he, David, he had a few people. He was, let's say, you know, killing off a few of his competitors also, you know, because it's clearly also in that article from the Irish Times, it says that David gave order to get people killed. I mean, you, how do you say the saying? You put sword up and you'll die by the sword. I mean, when you start killing people yourself, I mean, these things happen. But yeah, and maybe thieves also, people who've been stealing, weren't straight, you know. Yeah, these things happen. It all depends also. It also depends with whom you work, because I've seen people here in Amsterdam stealing a lot, millions and millions, and they still walk around.
I mean, that's the nature of organized crime. It's very organized.
You know, the bigger the money, when it's about a lot of money, you could get serious problems. Serious money could bring serious problems. Although nowadays, what I read in the newspaper, they'll fucking kill you for small money also nowadays. Yes. You know, it doesn't mean necessarily to be millions anymore. I mean, I read stuff in the newspaper that these kids kill each other for fucking 5,000 euros or less even.
Another very interesting part of your whole journey is AIDS. Tell me about that.
HIV. That's a very different thing. Yeah, when I was in the jail in Spain, 2015, they asked, you know, if I could give my blood, the routine check or something. So I did. And I didn't hear nothing from it for like 4 or 5 months. And then I went to the doctors because I had athlete's foot, you know, because communal showers and everybody's standing in the fucking in each other's shit. And so I went for a cream for my foot. And then this doctor, he gives me right away a little tube. And he looks at this old geezer with reading glasses, and he looks in the computer. And he says, usted sabe algo de infección? I said, infección? VIH, sí, infección. I didn't know what he was talking about, you know? And then, again, infección. He pretended like he was playing with a ball and with a basket, like, mag ik gewoon zo'n? And they were like, he was playing in a basket, you know, imaginary. I think the dude lost his mind. And then he turns around his screen and he had a picture of Magic Johnson. Magic Johnson? I think, fucking hell. And then he printed out the paper, HIV positive, D-I-H, they call it in Spanish, you know? So I was fucking in shock, mate. It was like I fell in a big, deep hole. And then, they put me in a suicide cell also on top of that for 2 weeks or 10 days without even a little pamphlet or information or psychological help, nothing. Thank God I had a little illegal phone, just as big as my thumb, and I could call my family. And I told my sister, like, fucking hell, this and that, you know. I said, we positive. Oh, brother, you need your medication. Don't worry, get your medication. Anyway, I gave some more blood, went to the doctor again, and they said, everything is fine. Everything is, there's no problem. You don't need any medication. Everything is fine. Okay, well, he's the doctor. Long story short, this took, I think, about 15 months. I went to the hospital also, the Virgin Hospital in Malaga. Also there, the doctor said, you don't need medication. Everything is fine with you. I even had a shingles attack. And, well, my sister said, listen, that's because of this HIV. You better get your medication. And again, when I went from the hospital, came back, they still didn't give me my medication. Then my older sister, she called the embassy in Spain. and they can swiftly pass by with two people. I signed for my that I could see my medical record, and then I got this so-called antiretroviral medication. Okay, that was 17, 18 or something. Then I went, when I came out, there was a very strong need, you know, in me to find some information about this. And there was a seed planted in my head. Why didn't they give me that medication? Why I had to wait 1.5 years, and only because my family warned the embassy. That's why they gave me the medication. So I knew then there's something wrong about this narrative. There's something, you know, because the protocol is you have to start ASAP. You can look it up on Google. You have to start the medication ASAP. Why did they wait 1.5 years with that? Well, once I came out, on Google, you don't find much. On YouTube, less even. Although, there's some good documentaries on YouTube. Strange enough, there's some stuff on YouTube lately. It's not getting so censored like before anymore. I went on Twitter or some social media, and I came into groups where there's other people, HIV positive also, who don't take their medication. So, yeah, that's, you know, I wasn't the only one. Hey, couple. And I wasn't the only one who doesn't take his medication. And I was, just because I knew there was something wrong with the narrative, I hardly took the medication either, you know. And then, strange enough, when they take your blood, they can see that. Then you've got a so-called virus load, whatever it is. I don't think it's a virus, or by the way. I think what I hear, it's a protein you produce in your blood, which even could be detectable with HIV negative people, what I hear. But all in all, I don't believe nothing of the narrative. I'm sitting here, I'm almost 6 years old. I think HIV positive from 2011, I think. Eh? 2015, they noticed, but it's from a few years before that. So you're talking about almost 15 years, and I'm never sick, Jeremy. Never, ever. Never, ever. I mean, most people don't fucking even believe it when I say it. They think I'm shitting. I'm shitting around because they think about this cliche image of a skinny poofter, homosexual, you know? That's what they think, you know, with a few of Kaposi sarcoma spots left and right in his body, you know. That's what they think. Yeah.
You know. I mean, look, so you're preaching to the converted. So I don't think ARVs are, I think they're toxic. I don't think they help you in any way whatsoever. What was the ARV that they gave you? AZT? Yeah.
No, that was already way. We're talking about 2015, Jeremy. I think that AZT was till end of the 90s or something, maybe middle 90s. I think middle 90s. Then it went to the combination therapy, which I never had. And I was already in the ARV, in the APOCA, you know, the time of the antiretroviral stuff, you know.
So when you say you don't believe the narrative, what do you mean?
But,
nah, it's all.
Listen, I'm not the only one.
It's all nonsense. It's all nonsense.
I know a few. I know. It's all nonsense. Yeah,
to make money.
It is. It is. It is. And now, for example, because of course I paid 8 years of my life. I sacrificed in jail for stories surrounding, you know, grass and hash, which is, I mean, come on, alcohol is more, you know, it brings more damage than that. And for laundry of money. And there's a bunch of people, like Kerry Mullis says, you know, the AIDS establishment is guilty of a heinous crime, he says, I think, you know, the Nobel Prize winner. And I'm contacting, for example, my insurance, because in Holland, they 170 million euros a year, they describe it, this medication, this ARV. It's very expensive medication. 25,000 people here in Holland are HIV positive. It's costing 4% of the total budget for medication here in Holland. And it's fraud. It's fraud. In my opinion, it's fraud. Yeah, I can't make anything of them. So I contacted my insurance about this. I said, listen, and then I explained my whole story. They don't even have the decency to say, yeah, we receive your mail in good order and we think this or that. Nothing. They're just nothing. So then I looked up on a fraud division about health insurance. And they, again, referred me to another division. And this one, again, anyway, boom, boom, boom. And at the end, I got referred to a board who decides the guidelines, you know, surrounding HIV. And actually, recently, they sent me a mail back, you know, after quite a while. And they came with I think I sent it to you, no? But these ones referred me to a board of doctors who determine the guidelines every year, yeah? And they, recently I got a mail back, and this lady said, we're very happy, you're healthy, but unfortunately for the majority of the HIV-positive people, they get very sick, and when they don't take, and she sent me a report of, they call it elite controllers. So there's HIV positive people who only get like maximum 200 parts of virus, you know? They just don't, it doesn't get bigger, the number of virus. And she said, well, they age quicker, you know? And then she sends me some report of 2012 with a whole bunch of names of doctors on it. And that they get more people who don't take the medication, you know, these so-called elite controllers, they are quicker in the hospital, they have more respiratory problems, and they age quicker. Yeah. And then she sends me a year report of HIV organization, how many HIV people live in this province and there, and which nationality, and blah, 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 blah. So I send her a mail back. I said, listen, is this it? On the basis of what you sent me, is this that you guys spend 170 million? I mean, shouldn't you? Because I know now already four people personally in my phone. I know four people personally who don't take the medication, and all of them, including me, five, are totally healthy. Are totally healthy. And one of them even 23 years. No medication, healthy. Recently another guy who lives nearby here, he started again because he got a pneumonia. He said, Eddie, listen, Evert, I started again because my doctor said you better start taking it again. But look, you have pneumonia. But what does that say, Jeremy? Pneumonia. I mean, hundreds of thousands of people get pneumonia. A mate of mine, Gavin, recently, he got 2 times pneumonia in a row, and he is HIV negative. It doesn't say fuck all. I mean, when you look in Google also, when you put in HIV and nails, HIV and eyebrows, HIV and kneecap, you'll find something. You'll find something. It's such a broad spectrum. And to make it more foggy, you can get it within, first it was 1 to 3 years. They stretched that up. Now 3 to 7 after that, then 7 to 10. Now already when you look on Google, it's 10 to 15. I mean, it could take 2 decades and you can get anything. I mean, how more vague you want to have it?
You corrected me earlier when I said AIDS and you said it's very different. What do you mean?
AIDS is the syndrome. That's why you have a disease they call AIDS, you know, that could be anything. Officially, you have less than 200 T4 cells, but that's a story too. I went down this rabbit hole, Jeremy. I'm a fucking expert. I know more about this disease than most ordinary GPs, you know? And honestly, always I ask questions to them. Always I tell my story. Up till now, not one doctor can persuade me to take this medication because all of them have flimsy stories. You know, recently, there's a doctor around the corner. I've got a new doctor since I'm back in Holland. He's about 43, 44, 45 or something. I told the guy, I made some people. Oh, yeah, he had to make a new file about me because they didn't know me. I said, well, I made some people positive. He said, oh, okay, which medication you have? I said, none. Oh, really? Well, I said, and I told him the story, what I'm telling you now, you know, how you call it? Yeah, quickly. And then he said, well, you better take care because I know people in the 80s, 70s, 80s who died from it. I look at him. How old are you then? And then he's right around them. Oh, listen, just okay, bye bye. And, you know, I mean, bollocks. The guy didn't, he's all bullshit. That's the whole thing. Most of the people think they know it. And you know, it's good to tell you this whole story to, you know, because then I can just refer people to this interview.
Was it worth it?
Yeah, it was, yeah. I only wish I was a bit more smarter with my assets and what I did, you know. I should have preserved, as you say, maintained what I had, which I didn't, because I owned like quite a bit of real estate in Amsterdam in the 90s, which is worth a fortune now. I had a farm outside town. And now I've got what? I've got fucking a nail to scratch my bum hole. I mean, it's bad at the moment. Yeah.
How do you find work after a career or a career, quote unquote, like yours?
Well, I've got it's not easy, but it's got more to do with my age, I think, and just because I'm not a character for having a 9-to-5 job. It's it's not going to work, but I'll manage. I'll survive, man. I mean, yeah.
And with regards to HIV, what is the moral of the story there?
I don't know. I like to, I'm rattling that cage, man. I know, and I would like to, you know, that's why it's very nice to be on your show, Jeremy, that people just know, because still I notice when I go to not everybody knows it, after this story, the whole world knows, but sometimes I go to a birthday party and you notice that people are different because they know. And when they kiss you or something, you know, hey, they all turn the face, you know, all the way like that. Or you, when you want to play with the kids, they're like, better don't touch my kid, you know? And it's so. And for what? For a total bollocks story. Recently, for a medical thing, actually, I could have went to Cape Town to some friend of mine said you could go to a clinic, although I don't drink or use drugs anymore for quite a while, nothing. But I thought, well, when the insurance pays it, he'd just been there like a clinic for addicts, you know? I think, why not? So now he starts there with another, this dog. Anyway, so I thought, well, let's try it. And of course, they saw in my file, said it was HIV positive. And this doctor asked me also, said, well, you could go there, yeah? But you don't take any medication. So that's my choice. Well, then you can't go to this clinic. You can't. You have to start your medication. Then we can talk again. So, well, I'm not going to do that. It's, you know, this ARV medication is all based on chemotherapy, man. That's fucking. Yeah. It's shite stuff. It's very bad for you. It's very bad. And all these people, I go to this HIV society here. It's nearby here. They have every Wednesday at 2 o'clock. You can eat there. And there's like 50, 60, 70 HIV positive, mostly men. I would say 90%. Homosexuals, my age and older. And there's two others, Bill and me, and another guy who don't take the medication. And believe me or not, I was looking over these people there. And I said to him, he was sitting there, I sent a message to Will, you know, the other guy who doesn't take his medication. And I looked at all these people, and I said, Will, you know, I sent him a text. I said, you and I look the best from all of these people here. That all looks really, really, I mean, yeah, what it is.
Why do you think that is?
I mate, you're taking, this is 24, you're bombarding your body year 365 days a year with poison.
Yeah. So you're saying that they're poisoning themselves. That's what's going on.
Well, I remember when I took the stuff, when I came out, I was heavily on the drink, on the beer every day. And I took the medication. And I remember the friends of mine said, mate, your eyes look yellow. Mm-hmm. But you know, it was too much work for my liver. Alcohol and that stuff, they're not tiny tablets, eh? They're fucking big fuckers you have to take every day. But I came to the conclusion, whatever HIV is, to which extent it's a lie, I don't know. Is it a lie for 60%, 70, 80? It is. There's so many things wrong with it. You know, and the answers I got from this board recently, you know, sending me these two files and the story, I send a message back also, well, this doesn't really impress me at all. And it only acknowledges my suspicion surrounding this HIV story. You know, I do have to say, because people there in this society, we were sitting at a table and people know I don't take the medication and also my mate. But most of these people, when I would sit there and a dude like me came in, like, I don't take the medication and he's healthy and I would be very interested in his story. But these people don't want to know. They don't want to know. They don't want to know. It's just, you know, they are so, whatever, brainwashed, you know, these people. And they rather just keep on, you know, it gives them safety. I take this tablet every day, and that's what they told me. And now, they don't want to hear about it, most of them. They don't want to hear about it.
Would you say that where you are now in life is a success?
Well, I'm going through a quite hard time at the moment, you know, after this last attention. Yeah, you know, I lost my house in Spain. I had a villa there, divorce. And now recently I had a rental house. The second time I had my detention, I lost all my belongings. When I came out, everything was gone. I literally had one bag with a few pence in it. Nothing anymore. I had to start from scratch. It's quite a journey, of course, you know, when you had so much fucking money like I had. I mean, I describe it in a book also. I mean, I was just flying in only business class, going on holiday skiing every year to Zermatt or Austria. And then we not even taking the elevator, we took the fucking helicopter, you know, to the top of the mountain. Stuff like that. I've been all over the world. I've been...
But you won't go back to drug trafficking.
Nah, there's no money in it anymore, Jeremy. It's gone. There's no money in it. Nah.
Eddie, how can my audience get your book, Fast Women, Slow Horses?
Yeah. Well, at the moment, it's actually on their way. I've got here a little thing here. This is it, so the people know how it looks. Look, three ladies, 1, 2, 3, in the red light. Well, I need to. Actually, I went yesterday to the Chamber of Commerce because I want to put it on on Amazon and bol.com, but you need to have a number, you know, like a business number. So I'm busy with it. Unfortunately, it's only available here in Amsterdam in the coffee shop where it all started, in Rick's Cafe, in the red light district, and in a bookshop coming week. But for the moment, you can't get it on. But I tried to fix it ASAP. Just remember the name, Fast Women, Slow Horses, and you probably find it, you know, if you're interested in it. You enjoyed reading it, no?
Yes, it's fascinating. But again, it's about the journey that's so interesting. Tell me something quickly. And just for those wondering how I've got it, it's a digital copy, which you very kindly sent me. Before we go, there will be a few people asking, why am I calling you Eddie?
Yeah, I mean, it's easier for English people. Evert is difficult to pronounce. They say Everett or they can't pronounce Evert. So I lived for 25 years in Spain and the Costa del Sol. It's loaded up with Brits there and none of them could pronounce my name. So I always said, Eddie, call me Eddie.
Evert, thank you for joining me in the trenches.
Well, I enjoyed it.
If you enjoyed this, please visit germwarfare.com.